Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. I'd like to start by welcoming the new stations across Alaska carrying Line One for the first time, and especially welcome new listeners across the state. And of course, welcome back to longtime KSKA listeners. As you may have noticed, we've loaded up the truck and moved from Monday afternoon to our new time on Wednesday morning, and many stations will be rebroadcasting the program on Wednesday evening. If you're a first-time listener, I'd like to welcome you. The format is a topical call-in talk show. Each week, my co-host, Prentice Pemberton, and I will do a deep dive on a topic from the world of health, medicine, and science with special guests. And the most special guest is you. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also contact us by email at lineone@alaskapublic.org. That's lineone@alaskapublic.org. Over 1.5 million Americans experience homelessness in any given year. They face numerous health risks and are disproportionately represented among the highest users of costly hospital-based care. Today, we're going to be discussing the role of housing for health. And my guests are Dr. Monica Gross, Vice President for Community Impact at United Way of Anchorage. Welcome, Dr. Gross.
Thank you very much.
And we also have a special guest. Dr. Gross, you're not special also, but Dr. Richard Monsager, former CEO of Providence Alaska Medical Center, also former director of the Alaska Division of Public Health and longtime director of the Alaska Native Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Monsager.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Very good. So let's start with a very broad question. When we talk about homelessness and the health status of people who are experiencing homelessness, what do we mean by homeless?
I think that the word itself really describes what we mean. Homeless, meaning people who don't have a safe home, a safe place that they call home. HUD, which is Health and Urban Development,
Housing and Urban Development
defines it very strictly, so we can get into semantics, but really, it's really what it says, people who don't have a safe home to live in.
Okay. So we oftentimes picture the people that we see on the street, but oftentimes there's behind the scenes, the couch surfers, people who really don't have a regular home, take whatever steps it takes to have some sort of shelter over their head each night.
Absolutely. And in rural Alaska, people may have a home to live in, but that home may not be safe. It may have mold or it may be overcrowded. So even though that doesn't meet the strict definition of homeless, it really is housing insecurity.
And I think you raise a very important point. We may think of homelessness as more of an urban issue, but it is also a rural issue.
Absolutely.
Okay. So at any given time, how many people are experiencing homelessness in Alaska?
Well, just like the definition of homelessness is complicated, counting homelessness is also complicated. There's different ways that we count it. HUD counts it very specifically, using a point-in-time count in January, where volunteers go out into communities and they try and count everybody who's in shelters or on the streets or in their cars. When you look at the point-in-time count from this last January, we had 1,100 homeless people in Anchorage and 920 across the rest of Alaska. But there are other ways to count it as well, and sometimes that's why it's confusing. You hear of numbers going up or down quite a bit, and people get excited about that, but often we're comparing apples and oranges. And so you have to be very careful when you hear a number to make sure that it's comparing an old number that's used the same way.
So the best case scenario may be roughly 2,000 people statewide homeless at any given time, but that's likely an underestimate because of the way we count these people.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And in Alaska, we have a lot of seasonal variation in homelessness. People may be living in camps and at different times of the year or living with relatives in the winter, so the number can really fluctuate up and down. But I think that's accurate, about 2,000.
Yeah. Dr. Gross, I've heard you say in some of our discussions as we were about to go on the air that homelessness is a symptom, there's a lot of causes for that symptom. What are some of the issues that lead to homelessness?
I really think of homelessness as a continuum of things that cause homelessness. And some of those causes can be very, very simple, like somebody misses two rent payments because they're ill. And this is a person who potentially has a job, is employed, but is thrown out of their home because they can't make a rent check. That person needs very, very simple short-term help to get back in their house. We call the intervention in that case rapid rehousing. Then there's people in the middle who maybe are just released from prison or having a little harder time that need a little more support, maybe 6 months of support and maybe some vocational help. That we call the intervention transitional housing. And then we have a group of people on the far end who have significant, usually behavioral health issues, that the intervention is probably permanent supportive housing, meaning that these people aren't going to make it on their own and they really need permanent support.
So kind of synthesizing that into some of the maybe three major drivers of homelessness. One is an economic impact, which may actually, as you used in your example, may actually be a health cost or a health bill that can't be paid that leads to losing housing. People who are in transition and may come out of an institution and not have any kind of stable housing to go to. And then persons who are experiencing chronic homelessness, which it sounds like is an area of particular interest to our discussion today as we get into permanent stable housing. So I think there's oftentimes a stereotypic image that we'll have of people who are experiencing homelessness from what we see on the street corners, in the urban centers as we wait for the light to turn green. Your work, my question is, has your work provided a clearer picture of who is homeless in Alaska, sort of getting beyond just what we may see as we move around the state?
I think what's important is that every homeless person has their own story and that we really need to look at each homeless person as an individual and learn their story and figure out what it's going to take to help get them into a home. That there's not a basic picture of who's homeless and what that person looks like.
Okay.
You know, maybe I could add too, I think that there's a growing movement across the country to say, we need to know people that are homeless by name. It's not just a group of people. Everyone, as Monica said, has a story. And by name lists are a growing realization that we don't make a change unless we really know the people as people.
Yeah. So I think what you're exhorting us to do, Dr. Monsager, is to move beyond this being an issue of otherness or a problem that those people have, but something that we all as Alaskans need to address.
Correct.
So as we think about the health issues that people who are homeless or experiencing homelessness may have, we can spend more on that later, but just thinking about the population as a whole and health challenges in the 21st century, experiencing homelessness doesn't make you immune to the issues that we're all experiencing. The population is aging. Is that true for people who are experiencing homelessness?
We don't have long-term data on ages of homeless people. But we do know, when you look particularly at the shelter here in Anchorage, Brother Francis Shelter, that last year we saw about 800 people at Brother Francis Shelter who were over age 55. That's a significant population group. out of that 800, almost half of them have some sort of disability. So again, this is a group that needs extra support.
Right. So over 800, and that's out of roughly how many clients?
I don't have the exact number. Dick, do you know that?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
Fair enough. So you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. With me is Dr. Monica Gross and Dr. Dick Monsager, and we're talking about housing for health. And we welcome you to join the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. And if you're listening in the Anchorage area, our old-time local number still works. I'm looking to Dave to make sure that's true. He's not nodding, but I think that's still true. That's 550-8. He's giving me the thumbs up. Okay, 550-8433 still works. If you're listening to one of the stations that carries the taped rebroadcast on Wednesday evening, we can't take your questions, but we'd love to continue the conversation and would welcome your questions or comments by email. So as we are talking about health among people who are experiencing homelessness and the concept of housing for health, I know that there has been some work done in Anchorage to provide respite care for people who are coming out of the hospital. I think as a provider, it's always struck me as ironic that someone who's experiencing homelessness may come into the hospital, may spend several days in the intensive care unit, maybe spend a day on a general medical or surgical ward, and then is discharged and basically is back on the streets, back to a tent or under a bridge. So, Dr. Monsager, you've been involved in establishing the respite clinic at the Brother Francis Center. Tell us more about that.
So I guess I would like to start by quoting a doctor some 5 or 6 years ago in Spokane who talked about, and this was a reality check for me. He said, as an ER physician, housing is the first and most important prescription. It's really hard for people to heal if they're in crisis as to where they're going to stay safely at night, as Monica had already said. So over the last 3 or 4 years, the hospitals in town and Brother Francis Shelter, Catholic Social Services, learned from other communities in America, California, other places in Washington and Boston, and opened in the spring of 2017 our first medical respite place. It's down at Brother Francis Shelter. There's capacity for 10 people at any one time. And the idea was, as you were said in your introduction, is people that are discharged from an expensive hospital, putting them on the street seems like a very bad idea. And if you're thinking economically, it's a bad investment. And the idea I thought had at first was this would be people primarily with frozen toes in the wintertime that needed to get better or infected extremities. In fact, the first 6 months, there were as many people with cancer and liver disease, other chronic diseases that needed ongoing treatment as there were people with skin or extremity problems. The funding has been provided by the three hospitals in town, Alaska Regional Hospital, Alaska Native Medical Center, and Providence Alaska Medical Center. And the idea was we had people sitting in hospitals that shouldn't be in hospitals, and care could be provided at a much lower cost in a medical respite environment. And that has proven up. In Providence's case, where I was at, in less than a year, we had offset costs in the hospital for uncompensated care at a lower cost, and I think that's also true at the other two hospitals.
So respite care provided an opportunity not only to have this transition after discharge from the hospital, but actually allowed earlier discharge from the hospital?
Correct, and there was one other component to this, because respite is housing and meals in a safe place. Home health care sometimes has come when people have needed dressing changes or other antibiotics to support them, just like as if you were in your own home. And at the same time, South Central Foundation collaborated with Brother Francis Shelter to expand what had been the volunteer clinic down at the shelter into a 40-hour-a-week scheduled clinic with a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner there all the time. And that person then is available also for people in respite, not just the people that are on the street needing ongoing urgent care. In Boston, this idea has expanded such that they have 24/7 availability in shelters to be in a couple of shelters to be able to admit people from the emergency room if somebody breaks an ankle, say, in a fall, and ordinarily would be splinted and go to your home and then come back potentially for surgery later. If you're homeless, what do you do with somebody? And I think aspirationally, several of us now are in Anchorage are starting to think about, are there enough patients here in Anchorage that that kind of an expansion would also make sense in our community?
Okay. So I want to really key in on something you said, as if you were in your own home, because for many of us who have a roof over our head every night, if we had that kind of injury, we would not go into the hospital, we would go home. So what we're talking about is not just a place to go after discharge for transition, but even an alternative to hospitalization that most people who are not experiencing homelessness would be able to benefit from.
There's a whole other population of patients in our hospitals who need to be discharged, don't meet criteria for hospitalization, but get stuck in hospitals because they don't have adequate housing or support. They may be single, they may have burned through family relationships, and so finding assisted living facilities or other housing solutions is an expanding responsibility, I would say, of hospitals. There was nobody ever anticipated that hospitals would get into housing after leaving the hospital, but it's a growing need. One might say, how come hospitals have to do it? But the practicality is otherwise they're stuck in hospitals at a very expensive price.
Okay. And for someone who goes into respite care, is there a limit to how long they can be in bed? And I'm speaking specifically about the respite clinic at Brother Francis.
No. The one patient was there for ongoing outpatient cancer therapy for several months.
Okay.
Most people have been there for less than 30 days, but some people have been there for a longer period of time if needed.
And some of those people have moved into long-term housing.
I think that that's the other really important thing is almost two-thirds of the people then by intensive case management and social work support while they're in respite have moved into permanent housing rather than back to the streets. So they're taking advantage of this crisis with support, as Monica said, permanent supportive housing, in this case social work support, has really paid off.
Okay. So we have a caller. So let's welcome Chris. Chris, welcome to Line One, your health connection.
Hi. Yeah, it's kind of along the line of subject of what you guys are talking about. I was 2014. I got sick. I've had a bunch of health issues since then. I've got end-stage renal disease. I go to Fairbanks 3 days a week for dialysis. I have been able to have a shuttle company that's here in Delta rearrange their schedule to get me up there. My main concern is I have a house down here in Delta, and after several years of bouncing around in hospitals and such, I've been able to get back home, which has been huge in my life. And my main thing is that I have an amputation. My left leg was amputated, and so my problem is that I was working on my house, and it's about 7/8 done, and my bathroom now has to be turned into a handicap bathroom. I can't do the work myself anymore due to obvious reasons, and I'm looking for some sort of a grant or funding or something where I can pay a contractor to come in and, where I was going to put a tub and all that type of stuff into my bathroom. Now I need a low level, just a shower where I can go in and sit down and be able to do that. And then like my toilet that I haven't currently installed is too low to the ground. I need to bring it up. Anyway, I'm looking for some sort of a grant, some sort of funding to help me out with that, because I'm on full disability with, limited, very, very limited funds.
All right. So Chris raises two issues here. And so one is the issue of transportation. And Chris, I'm really happy that it sounds like that's an issue you've been able to address in terms of accessing dialysis services in Fairbanks, and that you're able to actually be in your home in near Fairbanks. But then you raise another question in terms of someone who has inadequate housing for their health needs and what opportunities there are. So maybe if we could try to tackle both of those issues in the discussion now. I'll look to the panel. Monica, you seem eager to speak.
Well, I have one thought, and I really appreciate your call. Do you have a primary care doctor?
Yes, I have a primary care doctor here in Delta Junction, and I also have a neurologist that flies up from Anchorage once a month to see us at the dialysis clinic.
You know, Alaska is really moving towards this medical home model of care, where primary care doctors can become kind of your focal point for helping you with care coordination and helping you with some of these construction issues that you're talking about. So I would start with your primary care physician, because with Medicaid expansion, there are resources available to primary care doctors to help with care coordination and some of these other issues you're talking about, including transportation. So that's one thought I have.
No, I think that you highlight one of the weaknesses in our current system, and it goes back to where we started about, is you don't need a lot of money and you don't need ongoing support. You need a one-time financial assistance. My dream is that we statewide can move toward a way in which the supportive housing funds are available on a grant basis to individuals or somebody by you, like you. I think at the moment, though, as Monica said, it's your primary care doc and the social worker you're partnering with to try and navigate an incredibly complicated bureaucratic system that needs to be simpler.
Okay. Well, Chris, I hope that's some help. Thank you for calling. We need to go to a break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host today, Dr. Jay Butler. My guests are Dr. Monica Gross of United Way of Anchorage and Dr. Richard Monsager, former CEO of Providence Alaska Medical Center here in Anchorage. Our topic today is housing for health. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Call us statewide toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. You can also connect us with us by email at lineone, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. And if you're in the Anchorage area, the local number is still live, 550-8433. If you are listening to one of the stations that has the taped rebroadcast on Wednesday evening, we can't take your questions, but we'd love to continue the conversation offline, so feel free to send us an email. So let's talk about some of the other things that have been done to address the health needs of people who are experiencing homelessness. Housing first is something that has been in the news over the past 5 years. So what is that?
Housing first is an approach to quickly put people into housing. It does not require any preconditions before somebody gets housed. For example, it doesn't require someone to become sober or to get off drugs or to treat their mental health issues. It recognizes that doing those things when you're living on the street is almost impossible. And so the thought is housing first. Get somebody into a house and then give them the tools so that they can deal with these other issues that may be affecting their life.
So in a number of the cities in, around Alaska and Anchorage, we've had Karluk Manor for over 5 years now. There's Forget Me Not in Juneau. I believe Tanana Chiefs Conference has a Housing First Center in Fairbanks now. Are these programs making a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, they're making a difference for the people who live there. These people are being provided with a safe, stable home, which is absolutely fantastic. But also when you start to drill down into the numbers, we've had quite a few evaluations done of these various places. We're seeing that the people who live there use the emergency room less, use emergency services less, potentially go back to prison less. Some of the data on actual health care usage is a little up and down. What we're finding is as people get housed, sometimes they do have deferred health care chronic conditions that need to be taken care of. But when you look overall, there's really good national data now that these types of places, Housing First sites, do save money and people feel better and are healthier.
Can I add one thing?
Absolutely.
I think that in addition to the emergency services, should we call out, it's not just the 911 system. It's also less police interaction, people that are housed. One of the things I thought was interesting as I started reading some articles in preparation for today is that I hadn't thought enough about is when you move somebody off out of homelessness into housing, in some respects, it can become somewhat isolating. There is a community that exists when people are in and out of shelters and so on. And all human beings need community and relationship. And so there's several reports in the literature that people's sense of isolation actually can get a little worse, at least in the short term, once you move into housing. And we shouldn't discount that. And we need to pay attention to it as we support Housing First efforts.
So you're saying there's better ways to do this? There's a right way or a wrong way? But the outcomes are certainly better. And just anecdotally, it seems like if we go back 8-9 years, we used to frequently hear reports of people being found dead in Anchorage. I don't know the data if that's less frequent now or not, but I can't help but wonder. So we don't have the data on that right now, but certainly there is data on some of these other health outcomes.
Well, you know, it's very clear that the emergency room usage drops substantially once people move into Housing First programs. It's really impressive.
So some of the objections to Housing First are, well, you're just warehousing people. Certainly there's pushback along the lines of not in my backyard. How do you respond to those questions?
You know, I think you're right. Sometimes people do feel like before they house somebody, they want them to be clean or want them to be dry off drugs and alcohol. And unfortunately, for some people, that's just not possible. And I think you have to become data-based and really realize that this is an evidence-based way to treat people who are homeless and move past the morality issues and really hit it head on that this is data evidence-based treatment.
You know, I think I would add that I think the data is very compelling for many cities now that police and EMS interactions drop in Housing First places, and that from a community perspective, a community-wide perspective, the community is much better off to have people in Housing First. Now, we have to confront the sense of other that we talked about at the beginning when you have people, primarily single males, now moving into a Housing First community. There has to be close relationships with that community to deal with sense of fear and so on and make clear that these are people for whom relationships are possible.
And some Housing First is single site, which are very visible, but some is scattered site where you have smaller groups living in apartment buildings or apartment complexes. The veterans have been using the Housing First model in the last few years. We have vets in every zip code in Anchorage living in a Housing First model, and we don't hear about them. There's not a big outcry, and obviously they've served our country, and I think everybody recognizes that. But also, I think it's showing the success of the model.
Right. And I think you raised early in the show the issue of cause and effect. And when we think about the role of substance use disorders in homelessness, the challenge of substance misuse may really be exacerbated by being homeless. So that seems to fit with the data you were just sharing a few moments ago about the incidence of alcohol or drug-related problems among people receiving services through Housing First.
I completely agree. I participated as a volunteer in the homeless count this last January, and it was so cold. I don't see how people can live on the streets without using drugs and alcohol, just to numb the pain.
Yeah, that was not a medical recommendation, just to be very clear.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's go to Albert in Anchorage. Albert, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Thank you very much. Happy to be on. Thank you for the program and the topic. I think it's well worth the conversation. Appreciate you being there.
Very good.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
okay.
We can. What can we do?
Well, I guess it's a simple question. I don't know. It's mostly for my own edification, but I manage a large commercial office building in Midtown. We've got a parking garage and a couple of acres of vacant land, and recently there's been a very noticeable upswing in crime, which has got us hyper attentive to all issues and around our property, and we've come to have a lot more face-to-face interaction with folks that are homeless or just disconnected from the community. You know, I've been putting myself out there. We've got security folks and maintenance folks, and we're all kind of frontline on the issue. And I've talked to several folks around town, and just to try to get advice as to how to best approach that issue, which isn't really at all the crime issue, but it's just that we're there because of the crime issue and trying to clean up just monitoring of our general tenancy. So the question is I guess I've got, you know, when I'm there talking to them and I talk to them, I try to get a first name and figure out what's going on. But at the end of it, you know, I've got, don't give them anything, look for medical. But, you know, even if there's a little bit of medical issues, or I just don't know what to do. And I'm wondering if there's general advice for the public and even in the commercial sector, what we're to do when interacting with these folks. Is it, you know, we're pushing them off our property, but I never feel real right about just saying, get the heck out of here and go somewhere else, when you can sense the help is needed. And it's, you know, the bus ticket, I've been told to get them a bus ticket to the St. Brother Francis Shelter or Beans Cafe, which seems a little bit of a reach for, you know, do you just hand them a bus ticket? So I guess it's just, is there any kind of short advice for us that are actually right there dealing with it? What do we do? Do we call an ambulance if there's a, you know, gashes and they're not, you know, it's not community service patrol, because it's not, I just don't know what to do. And I guess we're a little bit of frustrated at it, because we've been really hitting it, you're receiving it quite a bit, especially it seems within the last 6 months to a year.
Well, thank you, Albert. I think that's a question many of us have pondered. I think the frustration with this seeming hopelessness with the challenge of homelessness is a problem as well. You've raised two very good questions there. So what can we do? Dr. Gross, what are your thoughts?
You know, what you're describing is outreach to the homeless population, and particularly in your area, but really this is an issue throughout Anchorage right now, and I imagine the rest of the state as well. And Anchorage is beefing up their outreach mechanisms. They've put in place something called a mobile intervention team that has social workers engaged with police and fire to help do outreach to these clients. And that's actually something we can post on the website, how to get in touch with a mobile intervention team here in Anchorage. We're also looking at partners to potentially help with this outreach. For example, downtown has the Navigators, that the business community has in place. And there's going to be probably some training for these navigators around working with these individuals as well. But what you're describing is absolutely true. We need better outreach, and we need more outreach to these people to help them get into the system so that we can get them housed.
Monica and I were recently at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and the communities that have really demonstrated substantial improvement in reducing homelessness, outreach navigators is a key tool that's necessary so that, you know, I would dream in the not too distant future you would be able to call some number and access somebody who could reach out to these folks.
Okay. So in terms of what to do right now, though, what I think particularly the perspective that Albert brings as a business owner, any particular things that he should do? And I realize it may be very situational in terms of assessing whether or not someone is unconscious or, as he says, has a gash in the head. But Dr. Gross.
Well, certainly if you're concerned about a medical issue, you have to call 911, absolutely. What we're trying to do is avoid use of emergency services and to not be put in these emergency situations and to deal with them before they're an emergency situation to get these people support and housing. We're really working towards that goal, like Dick says.
Okay. Thank you, Albert. I've just been handed a note. Lisa Aquino from Catholic Social Services says, still thinks like an epidemiologist in terms of denominators. So regarding our question earlier about the 800 guests at Brother Francis who are age 55 or older, that's out of about 3,500 people who benefited from the services altogether. So I think that really does highlight that even though we've had a lot of discussion about young and male people who are experiencing homelessness, it is also an issue that impacts older people, it impacts women, and it impacts children as well. We have another caller. Mary, welcome to Line 1, your health connection.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks so much. I have a unique perspective on this because last summer...
Mary, you're cutting in and out. I'm not sure if what's going to be the
best. Phone.
There we go.
Okay.
Stand very still, and we can hear you now.
Thank you so much. Last summer, I was homeless. I tried to find an apartment because I'm disabled, and I'm also poor, and I was.
Oh, Mary, I'm sorry. I think it dropped, and we really want to hear from you because I think your perspective may be fairly unique. If you can hear me, is there any chance you can access email and send us a message by email?
I'm sorry, I'm poor. No Wi-Fi.
Okay. To summarize what we've heard so far, you've experienced homelessness. You have some health problems. Maybe while we have the connectivity, if we could focus in on your specific question. And I apologize that the connectivity is poor.
My question is more of a comment.
Oh, please.
My comment is, the people that you have speaking know everything A to Z on paper of how these things happen. But what we don't have are stakeholders, people who have lived it and are living it, getting their information in. What you have is the giant disconnect is Providence Hospital, well, Providence Foundation has given $17 million to help this. And nothing has been done other than a bunch of falsified documents from the nonprofit and hiring a whole bunch of more people. And it's disgusting what's happening in Anchorage.
Okay. Well, Mary, we certainly appreciate your perspective and the perspective of someone who has been there. And I agree that there's maybe no one who is more of an expert on the topic of experiencing homelessness around the microphone today than you. Dr. Monsugger, would you care to comment?
You know, I think your comment about that people like Monica and Jay and I have not lived it is absolutely correct. Engaging in a wave with people that have lived the experience or are living the experience is really important. It is, I think, an aspirational dream that we do much better at listening and learning from you all as to what's needed. You know, obviously, I might have a little bit different opinion about whether money is really being wasted or not, which I think is your interpretation, but your key issue that we need to engage with you and listen and talk with people who are living the experience is right on. I couldn't agree more, and we have not done a good job in the past.
And I also want to agree with what Dick just said, Mary. I really appreciate your call, and I think in the very near future, what you're describing, which is to bring people who have lived homelessness into the leadership group so that we do have your voice and that has been missing.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary. And that call may actually change some of the practices based on what Dr. Gross just said. So thank you for calling. We need to take a break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host today, Dr. Jay Butler. My guests are Dr. Monica Gross of United Way of Anchorage and Dr. Richard Monsugger. Until recently, Chief Executive Officer of Alaska Providence Medical Center. Our discussion today is on housing for health. Before we take the next caller, I wanted to spend a little time talking about permanent supportive housing and some of the work that's being done by United Way of Anchorage, particularly as it relates to something called Pay for Success. Dr. Gross, tell us more about that.
Sure. So in 2016, United Way received a grant from HUD and the Department of Justice to put in place a pay-for-success project around permanent supportive housing. And I'll describe what pay-for-success is in a little bit, but first of all was describing a population group for permanent supportive housing. And this grant wanted that population group to be very strictly described as these super utilizers. So when we talked about vulnerability, these are the people who are the most vulnerable. The way that they define it for this grant is people who have been in and out of corrections, people who are homeless, and people who are very high utilizers of healthcare and emergency services. So the first step was to look at how many of those people are there. And Agnew Beck did a feasibility report and came up with a number. About 330 people in Anchorage fit this criteria of these super utilizers, people who are using a lot of resources that have very significant healthcare needs and are homeless. So the next step is to design an intervention for this group, and the intervention is permanent supportive housing. And permanent supportive housing is not cheap. So we did a cost analysis. How much are these people costing us now? And it's basically about $48,000 a year when you look at all the utilization of emergency services, prison usage, healthcare utilization. How much would it cost to get these people in a home and assume that they're still going to utilize some services, but much less? And the answer was about the same, about $48,000 a year. So, and this did not actually take into account things like the trail system being a mess and other issues. So the answer is to put these people into houses with support is going to cost the same or be less money. And now we just need to figure out the financing of it. It's kind of a wrong pocket problem where we can't really say to corrections, oh, give us $1 million, because they don't necessarily have that money available. So it's using this pay-for-success funding scheme where you put in place a big fund of money from philanthropy or social impact funders who kind of kickstart the process. And then as outcomes are realized, the state or other payers like healthcare payers of the municipality would pay into the fund in the long term to keep these people housed with support.
So that gives us an idea of the way money flows, where it comes from, yet cost savings, while it seems to be the holy grail in the discussion around housing for health, that's not how we usually think about costs and benefits of usual therapeutic interventions in medicine, whether that be medication or a surgical procedure. If we were talking about high blood pressure or coronary artery bypass grafting, we'd generally be talking about the costs per what is gained in health economics. The term quality adjusted life year is sometimes used. I haven't heard that as much in the discussion surrounding housing for health. What type of analyses have been performed to understand not only how the cost neutrality that you describe is an attractive option, but also that quality of life is improved for the individual and for society?
There are studies that have looked at that, Jay, and many show that clients who are in housing have improved quality of life. But still, often these people have significant issues, whether it's addiction or behavioral health issues. And again, it's just so important to reiterate that these people probably need ongoing support of these significant issues from behavioral health teams and medical care teams.
Okay. So housing is not a panacea, but is certainly an important part of addressing the health of people who are experiencing homelessness.
Exactly.
Okay. So I'd like to go to the next caller. Stu has been waiting very patiently. Stu, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I did miss the first 15 minutes of the program because I was out with Greg Jacobson and Community Work Service picking up after part of our problem here. But I wanted to comment on what I observed in Japan. I lived over there for 11 years. And I think we could take some notes and maybe learn something from how they deal with homelessness. One of the things that I observed is they have a tradition of a community bath. They call it a sento. And my first condo in Japan had no bathtub or shower. And they expected you to walk, 100 yards down the street and go to the community bath. And so I did. My first condo in Japan also had no washer dryer. They expected you to walk 100 yards down the street and do your laundry at a coin laundry or a laundromat. And it was right next to the sento or the community bath. You could house a lot of people in something 150 square feet, and they would have your own unit. And the cost was amazingly low. And once you get accustomed to taking a bath with a bunch of other people and doing your laundry in a laundromat, it's actually a great way to build community. And anyhow, so I think maybe we might want to take a look at Asia and Japan specifically and see how just providing someone a secure place without an 840-square-foot condo, you know, can be enough if you have the facilities down the road. Another thing that I observed over and over again, and I was very impressed with, was those orange flatbed trolley things they push around at Costco and Sam's Club. The Japanese have reinvented those as a form of shelter for homeless people. And what they did was they have those in places like hallways of subways where they have a bathroom with running water that's open 24 hours. And the people stack their bedding. You can put about 15 people's bedding on one of those flatbed orange push carts you see at Costco. And then they have another one for duffel bags. And the people all have a secure place to store their stuff in the daytime. And then they come back and they have a change of clothes there and their oral hygiene stuff and their bedding. And the two of those flatbed cars can house 15 people in a facility like we have all over town, which could be a hallway in a high school or any one of these hallways they have in a number of strip malls. You know, guys, it's really disturbing when I hear in the wintertime about Brother Francis being too full. And, you know, I'm looking at myself and my relatives, and we all have car garages and they're heated, and there's people freezing out on the street because our society is so primitive and apathetic that we can't handle the situation. I really think we need to take a look at how they do things overseas. There's ways they need a secure place to store their stuff, a place to take a shower, and a place to sleep. And, you know, a bathroom. The idea that let's just find some more woods to shove them in, that's not acceptable. We need to find shelter for people. And if it's not official housing as you and I have, look at Asia. Even a tube hotel would be a very effective way to house people. Anyhow, I'll just listen. I hope you heard what I said.
Well, it certainly did, and thank you, Stu. I think you're addressing some of the basic needs of people who are experiencing homelessness. And it reminds me of a little of what I've heard about so-called mini housing. And I think there may be some experience with that in this country. But Dr. Gross, tell us more.
Well, thank you for the call. I heard a couple of things. The first thing I heard you say that I think is really important is how important a sense of community is to everybody, me, you, and people who are homeless. And that building that sense of community can be a protection against isolation and homelessness. So that point is very well taken, and I think it is very important as you provide people with permanent supportive housing, that part of the support includes a sense of community, and Dr. Monsager alluded to this earlier. The second thing that I hear you say is to really think outside the box about what housing necessarily needs to look like. And there are people doing that all over the world now, you know, small houses, tiny houses, collective living spaces. And so not everybody needs a big home with all the amenities. And certainly for people who are homeless, that may not be the gold standard. And I agree with what you're saying. And I do think that there are architects here in Anchorage that are starting to do that. Cook Inlet Housing Authority has done some innovative work, as well as other architects, AIM. So that's definitely something that we need to do more of.
Can I just say something?
Yes,
I think
please.
There are several experiments the last 3 years in various cities across the country. Houston is experimenting with something like this. San Antonio is, I just saw this week. San Diego is talking about a couple great big shelter kind of facilities for something similar to what the caller just talked about. So I think that experimentation is underway. How we translate it in our town with cold climates, I think, is a challenge that we don't have answers to yet in terms of something like this. But I think that definitely this is part of the continuum to explore and think about.
Right. And Stu also described what I think is sometimes being called mobile mini housing.
Yeah.
Is that something that has been looked at for Alaska?
I
guess you put it on skis rather than wheels for us, but
you know, I think everything's a possibility, and I think we need to look at all these options.
Okay, great. So we have actually one final question by email related to mobile assistance. So we've talked primarily about housing and different types of shelters. For people in the community, what can potentially come to people who are experiencing homelessness?
I guess I don't understand. You mean as far as people providing support?
Right.
So in scattered site permanent supportive housing, there are what we call ACT teams, assertive care teams, I think it stands for, and Choices, an organization here in Anchorage, runs these ACT teams where they can go out into the community and provide behavioral health support for people who live in scattered site. And then, of course, we have home health nursing for medical support and lots of medical support. But there is behavioral health support as well.
Okay. So we have about 2.5 minutes left. So to summarize, let me ask each of you, what is the take-home from the discussion today? Dr. Monsager, we'll turn to you first.
So the take-home for me is housing is a fundamental human need. I'm a pediatrician by background. Kids that aren't in stable housing don't do well in school. We know that school performance is really important for the rest of your life. And for us adults and for families, the human need of housing is something that as a community, I believe our goal should be zero chronic homelessness. And I think there are communities now that are getting there, and we should aspire to that.
So housing should be... homelessness should be temporary and rare.
And quickly addressed.
Okay. Dr. Gross.
And I would just completely agree with Dick. And also as a pediatrician, I would just say we need to look at homelessness as a continuum where some of the answers of homelessness are very simple and some are going to be more complicated, but it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Okay. Very good. So in summary, a big problem. But one where there are potential solutions and there's progress being made. So in terms of the permanent supportive housing that's part of Pay for Success, if I want to be involved as a businessman or as just a member of the community, what do I do, Dr. Gross?
Anybody's welcome to email me, mgross@ak.org, and also get involved with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, and we can put their website up on the webpage here. They have their bi-monthly community meeting. It's going to actually be this Friday at 10:30 at Alaska Housing Finance Corp. So people can go to that meeting.
Okay. So that's mgross@ak.org. And also, if you'd like to get involved here in Anchorage with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness, that meeting is this week, and their website is anchoragehomeless.org.
Absolutely. And there's a statewide organization as well, and we can put that website up too.
Okay, great. Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Gross, Dr. Monsager for joining us today on Line 1, Your Health Connection, and thank you to our callers and to all of you for listening today. Next week, Prentice Pemberton will return at 10 a.m. 2 weeks from today, I'll be back with Dr. Ira Chasnoff for a discussion of alcohol and drug use during pregnancy, what we know, how the effects can be treated, and how to prevent poor health outcomes for both mother and child. Dave Waldron produced today's program and was also our sound engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. This is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.